sadly, it was the time when pre-digital, and I have some film. I have a photo of all of us, all the brothers and my patient together in their, I'm going to say their home, but it was like a palace.
In the palace.
Just in the palace.
Hey, 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 everyone. Welcome to Keep Your Dinner Up Podcast. I'm Zana.
And I'm Jessica.
And we have such an exciting guest today. I'm going to give over to Jess to introduce him.
All right, guys. So strap in because it's a good one. we have a guest speaker today named KJ, who I met last year and instantly vibed with this absolute legend. He's very similar to us in every aspect, likes to have a chat. And one thing that he's told me about and the stories he's told me about that I just totally got inspired by was – like quite a lot, like in the 90s to 2000s, he worked in the Middle East, in Saudi. And that's actually what got me and Zana super inspired to live in the Middle East. And we were supposed to go to the Middle East. So, KJ, tell us a little bit about yourself.
Jess, Zana, thank you so much for having me on the podcast. It's an honour to be here. I'm excited to be here. I'm an old man.
You are not that old.
I am a registered nurse, clinical nurse, and you are correct. In the 90s, I had 5 years in the Middle East.
Nice.
At King Faisal Specialist Hospital. I can say it better in Arabic. Mustashfa Takasusi Al-Malik Faisal.
Ooh, that's fancy.
An amazing experience.
Yeah.
And lots to chat about. Lots of positive things. And I'm excited to talk to you all and maybe help someone on their journey if they go there.
Perfect.
Yeah.
Because you get asked so much as well, like when you've got a crazy experience like that with your nursing career. And they're like, oh, my God. And then they ask you a bazillion questions, I'm sure. I mean, I asked you a bazillion questions when I wanted to move to Saudi. But that's why we're doing this podcast, so that we can ask all those questions that we've been sent in and get all the juicy details. But before we get into it,
We need one special thing from you.
We're going to start with our spill the tea.
Yeah, give us your spill the tea, KJ.
Remind me, is it a happy, funny thing?
Can be whatever you want it to be.
This is a moral story.
Okay, it's a lie is a life story.
If you go to Saudi Arabia, the story I'm going to share. So I used to live briefly on the, like you guys, I lived on the equivalent of Queen Street in Saudi Arabia. I lived Olaya Street, which was it was Queen Street of Riyadh. And I had a blue Jeep Wrangler. I used to drive. Oh my God. And
bougie.
I loved driving in Saudi. They're maniac drivers. No offense to you guys. I love driving there. So I love driving with them. And I was a maniac. And on my street was a huge intersection. And one night I was running late for work. And I ran, I'm going to say, an orange light. The police said it was red.
Yeah.
Anyway, so I ran this orange light on the main street. And I got pulled over by some traffic police that were actually standing further down the street, and they pulled me over. So I went over, and they said they had to get someone that spoke English. So we had to wait a while. It was an awkward 5 minutes while a dual speaking police officer came along, and he said to me, "The guys tell me that you ran a red light." I said, "Oh, look, officer, I'm really sorry. I thought it was orange, to be honest." And he said, "You can't do that." And I said, "I'm terribly sorry." I said, "I'm from Australia." And I said, "If you're on an orange light in Australia, I'm pretty sure you can go through because it's safer to go through than slamming your brakes on." So that's the only reason I went through. He said, "Well, over here we stop on an orange light." And he said, "Our young people look at you as an example." He said, "We look at the West and the Westerners here to see how they behave, so that we look up to you for guidance." And I thought that was really interesting then, because it's like we forget it's a young country that's come a long way in a short period of time. When I say young in terms of modernization, and that really struck me when he said that. Anyway, they let me off.
Oh,
he was very kind.
Worked your charm.
He said, you know, please don't do that again. I said, officer, it won't happen again. He asked me where I worked. I said, I work at King Faisal. He said, if I ever have a problem, I call you and you look after me. I said, absolutely.
Oh, nice.
So I went on my way. No problem. The very next day, my friend ran that same night. He got pulled over. He was rude to the police and he went to jail.
Oh my God.
And he went to jail for a night. And when he came to work and I heard his tale, he's like, oh, poor me. And I said, you're an idiot.
Said, don't be rude to a police officer. I said,
would you be rude to a police officer in the UK or Australia or anywhere else in the world? Oh, no, I wouldn't be rude. I said, well, you're an idiot. Why would you be rude to a police officer in Saudi Arabia and think that they're not going to treat you the same as anywhere else? I would have thrown you in jail.
Got a taste of his own medicine.
Yeah, good on him for such a jail.
So that's my little
tidbit.
Love it. Love it.
Be polite to people. It goes a long way.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Anywhere in the world.
Yes. Agreed.
And it might get you out of a speeding fine.
Exactly. Or jail.
Or jail. Never know what's going to happen there. Well, Zana and I spill the tea.
Yeah.
Is if you listen to our podcast, like, ages ago, I feel like it was so long ago actually, like November, December. Like, we were actually supposed to move to the Middle East in June, which would have been in a couple of weeks.
Yeah, been going very soon.
Very, very soon.
Mm.
And we were so excited about the journey. We'd actually signed contracts. We'd gotten everything, like, everything was done, really. And turns out our podcast is very illegal there because of the fact that also it has the word gin in it. Keep your gin up.
Yes.
Yeah.
And we talk about very illegal things.
Yes.
like alcohol and sex.
Yeah, alcohol, sex, can't talk about that stuff. Sexual identity, can't talk about. So that's why we're just going to do a podcast about Saudi, because it's the only way we can do it now, because we can't go.
Because we wanted all these stories for ourselves to be able to tell them ourselves, but now we got you to tell them for us.
Perfect.
Yeah.
I'm excited.
It's going to be great.
So let's just start off with, what was it like working in Saudi? What drew you to the idea of going there in the first place?
Well, like with Jess, I bumped into someone, multiple girls I worked with in intensive care at the PA in the early 90s who had all worked over in Saudi, and they all had these incredible tales to tell. And I was only 23 at the time, and I had never left Australia, and I thought it, you know, it sounded like an amazing adventure.
Wow, you'd never left Australia. That was the first time you had travelled as well.
I hadn't left Australia.
Wow.
Wow. What a culture shock.
As we were saying earlier, that nothing I can tell you can prepare you for going there because it is like you've landed on another planet. For a young Australian male going there in the 90s, I felt like I had landed on another planet. And to any Saudis listening, I don't mean that in a derogatory way at all. It's just culturally, architecturally, landscape, everything is different.
Yeah.
It's unique. Would feel the same if they came here as well.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Very different. Definitely.
It's just a completely different experience. So to anyone who was thinking of going there, I would say, and I'm sure the recruiters would tell you this too, give yourself at least 6 months to get used to the place, because you will go through culture shock, no doubt, unless you've lived in a very conservative Islamic country previously. You can't imagine what it's like. It's different on every level to our society.
Perfect. Can't wait to get into it. We'll go into that a bit deeper. But we'll backpedal a little bit. So when you were exposed to the stories of them going to Saudi, how was the recruitment process? Like, did you just, I don't know, get in touch with their recruiter? Like, who did you actually go through with your recruitment?
So in those days, one of the big companies that was recruiting to my hospital from Australia was Bayside Personnel.
Oh, okay.
And I don't know if they're still actually trading as Bayside Personnel anymore. Yeah, okay.
I don't think I've heard that. We were going to go through CCM. They were really good. They were actually really good at replying to emails and calling and stuff like that.
Yeah.
So how long, so when you made the decision, was it 6 months that you went, or like a year? How long until you had to actually get on a plane and go?
It was at least 6 months.
Yeah.
The process is a long, slow process. I mean, in those days, obviously, you had to mail things in. It wasn't...
Yeah.
We didn't have the technology, emails and what have you. So you had to photocopy everything. Email was not an option. So that made it slower. But I think even today the process is still quite
laborious. Yeah, ours was going to be at least 6 months worth of, of stuff.
And we could do tell the paperwork was just, it was a lot, a lot of paperwork.
On the paperwork, while we think of it, to anyone who goes over there, photocopy every single piece of paper that you are ever given by them.
Mm-hmm.
Get it stamped with an official stamp from the hospital and just keep everything with you always.
Okay.
Because wherever you go, they'll ask you for a form. And, of course, when you don't have that form, then you have to go and obtain that form and then you have to get it officially signed. And that process might take you days. And then you'll go back and you'll give them that form. And then they'll say, and here's another form that you have to give.
Oh, God.
Yep.
Oh, and it's the same process. And you're thinking, why didn't you just give me that form when I was here the first time along with the other form?
Oh, at least you made it, though.
And so eventually you'll figure out that's just the way they do things. Mm. Maybe it's different now, but certainly back then they like to give you things one at a time.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. All right.
So
good night.
My advice is have everything on you that you're ever given, and then one day you'll have the joy of going somewhere and they'll ask you for a form and you'll give them the form and they'll be a little bit shocked and they'll say, oh, but you need another form. And you go, and here it is. And they say, but you need another one. And you go,
it's like, I got all of it.
And you go, I've got every form you could possibly want. And it's a great day.
Oh,
it's a
great day. God. So how long had you planned to move there for? Was it the 1 year contract, 2 years, three? So
my original contract was 2 years.
Two.
2 years with a bonus at the end. I went there to save up to get married.
Oh, wow. Really?
Yes.
So you did long distance.
So, yeah, I had a horrible, I caught up with my wife, who was my girlfriend at the time, 3 months in. We went to Europe.
Yep.
But then I didn't see her for 9 months after that. And then we got married. Then she came back and she lived there for about a year and a half.
In Saudi with you?
Yeah. So the first time we had, I had a year by myself, and then I had about almost 2 years with Kim, my wife.
Oh, wow.
Aww.
So we got to see some amazing things together.
Mm. Yeah, because you can obviously do a lot of travel, like on your times off in that region. Like, we were going to go to Egypt and, like, we had so many places we wanted to travel.
Lebanon.
Did you get 10 weeks included of annual leave in your contract?
They advertise 10 weeks. The way you get 10 weeks is I think you get 6 weeks.
Yeah.
But then if you're wise with the public holidays and you take them with your days off, then that will give you an extra 4 weeks.
Yeah. Because someone was telling us, because they advertise it so highly, like you get 10 weeks of annual leave and like you get, you know, you don't have to pay tax and it sounds like this really good deal. But then when you do talk to people, a lot of people say with the holidays, they're like, it's not actually 10 weeks.
No.
And then I was like, what do you mean? And then I was trying to figure out with my roster and I was like, hang on a minute, like, will it not actually be 10 weeks? Because that was the tipping point that really wanted me to take the contract. I was like, hell yeah.
You could definitely wangle 10 weeks. And I knew lots of people that were. I was a bit slow on the uptake in the first year. But that's how they did it. You tied it in with the Arabic public holidays over there and just took your days off that coincided with their public holidays, and then you would get an extra 4 weeks.
Wow.
Okay.
If you're clever.
And they have different weekends, don't they? It's not Saturday, Sunday. Yes,
correct. Their weekend starts on Friday.
Yeah. So Friday and Saturdays? And then Sunday to... How's that work?
Sorry, it's Thursday, Friday. Thursday, Friday.
Thursday, Friday's off, yeah.
Sorry, anyone Saudi can correct me if I'm wrong. I would have thought I'd never forget that.
They said it to me in the interview when I had... Our interview process was really, really weird.
Mm-hmm.
Like, we had... Zana had hers with a doctor in ICU and mine was with a nurse in recovery. Mm. And they just, like, FaceTime you on the phone. And then they're, like, you're literally just staring at their double chin this whole time because they're just working and there's patients and stuff around and there's nurses around. And they're like, yeah, so what happens if patient can't breathe? What do you do? And you're like, I need a little bit more of a backstory here. And they're literally giving you these clinical questions and you're trying to answer. And they're not paying attention. And then, like, one guy was like, he was blowing his nose. He put his mask back on. And then he'll be like, okay, sorry, what were we talking about? I'm like, you're interviewing me. It's like, what? And yours was so intense.
Mine was so intense.
She had, like, an ICU intensivist doctor, like, drilling her with questions.
Yeah. I was like, what is this about? I'm not a doctor. Oh, some of the things that he was trying to get me to say, like the answers, I was like, I don't know what you're trying to say. He was trying to get me to explain their like ALS pathway. And I'm like, I don't know your specific pathway. This is what we do here. And he was like, no, that's wrong. And I'm like, well, it's not because it's what we do. And then I thought I failed the entire interview because they went so terribly. But then he's like, okay, thank you for your time. And then I got an email like literally straight away from the consultant being like, oh yeah, he really liked you. You got it. And I'm like, what?
Yeah.
It was terrible.
They love, well, They used to love Australians.
Yeah.
Australian healthcare workers were held in very high regard.
Mm.
And in the time that I was there, a lot of the royal family had Australians from our hospital who were their staff.
Okay. Mm-hmm. I mean, Australians are amazing. I get it.
Well, it's interesting because the hospital used an American healthcare model.
Mm-hmm.
And hence...
Why the ALS was different.
The ALS was...
By the AMA or something.
Yeah, the American Health Heart Society.
Mm.
I found it very strange, all those questions. He asked me the same question about ALS. I was like, what? But then the reason he was I was asking about like what the shifts and stuff were like and the on-call roster. And that's when he said, he goes, about the weekends. He's like, oh, ours are different to you. Mm. I was like, oh, that's so weird. I was like, what? Should be Saturday, Sunday, man.
Mm. So speaking of your, like how you said that they base it off an American system, is it how they run the hospital is also like that? Because I know there's kind of some influences about how things run in the hospital based on, you know, power and money.
So talking about King Faisal Specialist Hospital, at the time when I worked there, it was a tertiary referral hospital and it was a specialist hospital and it was patronised by the royal family. But having read up on it, it's been turned into a corporation. So I'm not sure how the model works. I would imagine it's still funded by public money. But it was based on an American health model. They love lots of things American, despite what you might see about people ranting that they hate America. They have everything American there. Mm. And their health system is an American model. And but they have expats from I think, looking at their website, 67 different countries now.
Okay.
When I worked there, the dominant workforce was North American.
Mm-hmm.
So it's nice and easy for them, at least the same model. Mm. But for us, it's like you're not even just getting a culture different. Shock, you're getting like a career shock.
Yeah.
So you're like, oh.
Yeah, definitely.
And on that note, it's really good to look for the positives in a new system that you go to.
Mm-hmm.
There's so many people would go there, for example, from Australia and they'd whinge about, you know, in Australia we do things differently. Well, you're not in Australia. You're working in an American hospital in Saudi Arabia. So shut up and, you know, do your best practice. But just remember that, you know, you're a guest in someone else's country. You're a guest in a different healthcare system.
Mm.
So embrace it. And bring your best attributes to it, but don't knock it.
Yeah.
I can imagine there could be some quite confronting things. I know my friend, who's also an agency nurse that's working at Greenslopes currently, she worked in Abu Dhabi in one of the ICUs there, and she said that there was one patient and he had arrested. He'd been had arrested for a very, very long time. He was on the Lucas, I think, and then they ended up pacing him and every time that they did CPR, he would wake up during CPR, and that was the only time he was conscious. As soon as they'd stop, he'd be unconscious again with no underlying rhythm. So they put him on pacing, like just external pacing, for days, like literally days, till the time that he could go and get a pacemaker. He had third-degree burns from the pacemaker, from the external pacing. Like they did CPR on him for hours and hours, and then had external pacing for days. Like that would just not happen in a place like this. And she said it was a very, very traumatic experience that for her, she just felt like that was something she couldn't cope with.
Did he survive?
He did.
Wow.
Mm.
They look at death differently.
They do, yeah, very different.
So it's important to acknowledge that. So that is a big thing. That's a very common point that Western health professionals talk about,
mm-hmm.
is dealing with the process of letting someone die.
Yes.
They look at death very differently, and that's just something, you know, you need to, if you're going to go there, you need to research their views on death and just accept that that's part of your practice when you're there. That's how they deal with death. You're there to facilitate that.
Yeah. Is this the Muslim culture that you're talking about, or what?
Yes.
Yeah. So they believe the more suffering, which is what my friend said, the more suffering that you go through before death, the higher up you go into their version of heaven. So there's I don't know the word of what their version is, or what they're kind of where they go, but there's different levels. Okay. And the more suffering you suffer before your death, the higher up and the more respected you are when you die.
That's correct. That would be a fundamental view. Everyone's different.
Yeah.
But more conservative people would be happy to die comfortably.
Yeah.
I think I would like to die comfortably.
Yeah, me too.
I don't want that pacing shit on
me. No, thank you.
I had that same situation. I had a gentleman who he was a lovely man, but he was a very, very conservative Wahhabi Muslim. Mm-hmm. And he was dying a very painful death, and he wanted no analgesia, no pain relief in that process because of that very reason that you just spoke about, that he believed by suffering in this life that he would have a better life in
the next.
The next.
Wow. I didn't even know that before we signed those contracts too.
Yeah.
That would have been so confronting.
There's just a lot that you need to research that I guess isn't out there, which is great that we're doing this podcast for anyone who is going over there to listen to.
Absolutely. These are very things that I witnessed myself and had to deal with myself.
Yeah.
So it's good that even if we help one person have an easier time there, that would be...
Exactly.
It's just an easier transition as well, to be more aware. What was your work life, compared to an ICU here in Australia? What's the ICU like working in the Middle East? Same, or...
Patient ratios, things like that,
So... The ratios were very similar to Australia.
Yep.
The difference is they have respiratory technicians, the American healthcare system. So as critical care nurses here, you look after the ventilation. We do everything. We treat them holistically. We operate pheresis, whatever needs to be done. In the American healthcare system, they have... a lot more technicians.
Yeah.
So, and they tend to do the interesting roles.
Okay.
So they'll have a respiratory therapist who will do the ventilation side of things and caring for trachees and doing those dressings are shared responsibilities, which often means that the mundane stuff gets left to the nurse and they'll do the interesting things. But it also makes it quite... awkward when you go to an emergency because you turn up and there'll be 50 people in a room and you're trying to figure out who's who.
Wow.
The first time I went, I was, when I went there, a PA-trained critical care nurse, and I had an amazing training, which I wasn't aware of how amazing my training was.
Yeah, you would have.
And going there... and dealing with people less trained was quite confronting because I'd been used to a very high standard. And turning up at my first cardiac arrest and 20 people in the room with no one seeming to be in control was very interesting. And the first thing, because we were meant to be in control, was to ascertain who was doing what.
Wow. So you're kind of meant to be kind of like the ALS kind of team leader if you're going to be taking a role like that in Saudi?
Yeah, well, our intensive care was the emergency team.
Yeah, okay.
So if there was an arrest in another part of the hospital, then we went. But obviously doctors from all over the place turned up.
Yeah,
always do. Therapists turned up. And everyone in the American healthcare system wears a white coat.
Yes.
Okay.
So you don't know
who's who. What's going on?
Until you learn who, you know, when you actually get to meet people, but
yes.
It's still fresh. So
are you learning new skills when you're taking on a role like this, or are you kind of getting all your skills in Australia and then bringing them over to the country?
No, I did my hyperbaric certification.
Oh, cool. Over there. Yeah.
The hospital at the time, I'm not sure if they still run it. They had a hyperbaric unit. So I did my training in hyperbaric medicine, which was
very cool.
Was very interesting. And that was attached to our intensive care. And we could do ventilated patients in there. They did a lot of max fax treatment pre-surgery. So they used to, I don't know if they still do, they used to chew a lot of tobacco. So they had a lot of
oral cancers and stuff.
Correct.
Yeah.
And so they would work them up with hyperbaric therapy, then they'd zap them with radiation, then they would operate on them, and then they would continue treating them with hyperbaric afterwards.
Wow.
So it was a busy little unit, and it was really interesting.
Yeah, it does sound very interesting, actually. Yeah. Never been exposed to that.
It was a closed unit, which meant that when people came in, we locked the doors so no one else could come in. So I got to meet Arab people one-on-one, men and women and children, in an environment where they knew they weren't going to be walked in on by, because the country is very tribal. So there's blood feuds that go back hundreds of years with people. There's distrust of different people. So, but they know that we don't care about those sort of things. And if they feel comfortable with you, and they know the door's locked and they're not going to be interrupted, you get to meet the real people, which is really special. And they were the most trusting patients I've ever had. They were the most grateful patients as a group that I've ever looked after. And incredibly generous too.
Interesting.
Good.
So
let's go back. Let's just do it. Let's try and
No.
No, we can't. But it makes you want to go. When you hear KJ, you can hear his passion for it as well. And I was like, I want to go so bad.
Yeah. It'd be a very cool experience.
Damn our podcast being illegal. It's okay. We're getting all the goods from KJ.
But they offer tourism now, which they didn't offer in those days.
True that. Can still go.
Mohammed bin Salman, the crown prince, is really trying to modernize the country in a lot of ways. And he gave women the right to drive, the last country in the world where women couldn't drive.
Yeah.
Yes. So they got that right recently. When I was there, women couldn't drive, and that was a huge frustration for young people, men and women, because it's
just stupid, to be honest. But, I mean, we think of that as stupid, obviously. Yeah. They don't, because it's their culture, but... Yeah, it doesn't make sense. Actually, let's go into the culture. Like, so some people don't even realize, like, I didn't even know that about Saudi before talking to him, before potentially moving there, that women couldn't drive. I was like, what? What do you mean? Like, because they can now.
They can now.
But, like, only in the last 3 years.
Correct. And but you have to understand, so they've come in 30 years what it took the West to do in hundreds of years. I mean, if you look at medieval Europe and the laws that were in place then, they were Old Testament laws. We did the same things. We stoned people to death. We hung people. They've evolved within. Well, they're trying to evolve in 20 years or 30 years, the same way that it took us hundreds of years.
When you say it like that, it does make sense.
Yeah, very true, very true.
And so, you know, they're grasping with so many issues that they're trying to retain, you know, their conservative religion and culture, but also embrace everything that is good in the West. And it's hard. But one thing I love is their respect for the elderly. If you're old in Saudi, you are respected and loved. And it's a little bit of a golden handcuff for the young people in a way. But we all get old. So, you know, the respect and the care for the elderly over there was a beautiful thing.
So yeah, I guess going into the culture, obviously we know that women have just learned how, or just, sorry, been allowed to drive.
Yes.
Alcohol is still illegal unless you have a license to drink alcohol. Is that correct?
No licenses. It is.
Even in Saudi, nothing.
It is utterly illegal.
Okay. And I was like, oh, we could have gotten a license?
No, I know in Dubai they have, yeah, you can drink with the license.
Oh, okay.
Dubai, yes. Dubai, there's areas where you can consume alcohol and purchase alcohol. In Saudi Arabia, there is none of that whatsoever. Mm-hmm.
Okay.
For anyone getting involved with alcohol, like any country in the world, things that are prohibited, you can get.
Yeah.
Yeah.
If you know the right people.
But if you get involved with those things and you get caught, there are consequences anywhere. So if you do drugs in Australia and you get caught, there's consequences. You do alcohol in Saudi Arabia, which is there, and you get caught, there's severe consequences. So bear that in mind.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Places that you could drink in Riyadh were in the diplomatic quarter.
Yes. Yeah.
Yeah.
Because that is sovereign territory of whichever embassy you're at. But then bear in mind, if you drink in that premises and you drive out, you could get pulled over.
Yes.
And you could be sent to a public hospital and blood tested, and if you had a positive alcohol in your bloodstream, you'll go to jail.
Right. So how do you transport then from a party like that home?
Discreetly.
Because it happens.
Yeah.
Like we know people in Saudi, obviously, because we're going to move there. Like, we know it happens. They go to the embassy, they can have drinks there. We thought that. We're like, how do you get home when you're all giggly?
The population know that happens there, and they're very tolerant of what happens in that diplomatic area. Mm-hmm. Like, more so tolerant than probably they need to be, because there is some bad behavior there. And so there was kind of an understanding, I think, if you were discreet, we won't hassle you.
Mm-hmm.
Don't stick that in our face. And but certainly, you know, if you're drinking in just someone's home and you're having loud music, Western music, and you go out, there's a high chance that you would get caught. I got stopped when I first went there. I went to a BAE, British Air, BAE, the weapons company. I went to one of their compounds, and they were a known party compound. I'm a non-drinker. I didn't drink, but they could hear a party going on. And when I exited, there was actually police outside, and they stopped me. But they could tell that I hadn't drunk. So
you didn't get breathalyzed?
Yeah.
They didn't have breathalyzers in those days. They would just smell the alcohol on you.
And then
they'd take you to a public hospital, and they'd do a blood test.
You would have been like, oh, thank God, I'm not a drinker.
But again, I was polite to them, and they could see I wasn't drunk, and there was no problem.
Yeah. So I know you have a pretty heavy story in relation to alcohol and, you know, I guess smuggling alcohol into some places, if you want to share that one with us.
Absolutely. For anyone, just Google Khalid Kelly. Khalid Kelly was actually a friend of mine. He was Terry Kelly. He was a fun-loving little Irish nurse, critical care nurse that I worked with in intensive care. And he got involved in the illegal alcohol trade in Saudi Arabia, which was, with anything illegal in any country, there's potential to make a lot of money.
Mm-hmm.
And Terry didn't know when to call it quits, and anyway, he was caught, and he went to jail. And in jail, he was in there for a long time. In jail, he converted to Islam, and that's fine. I respect that. And he moved. Ultimately, he moved back to London, and he became a very outspoken, extreme, he became an extremist. There's no other polite way to put it. And ultimately, he joined ISIS, mm-hmm. when they emerged. And he ended up blowing himself up in an armoured vehicle at a checkpoint in Syria.
Mm.
But that all came about from alcohol.
Yeah.
From that one thing.
Mm.
Wow.
It is pretty fascinating as well. I know, obviously, converting to Islam is obviously his own choice and something that, you know, is fine for people to do. But how much, I guess, you can be manipulated or if you're put in a certain situation to believe that that's something that you need to do with your life is very sad, very scary.
I think most Muslims would not advocate you hopping in a car full of explosives and driving up to a military checkpoint and blowing yourself up.
Yeah.
Gosh.
I think most of the Islamic world would agree with us that that was just a tragic waste of life.
Yeah,
on
very
both
sad.
Sides.
Mm. Yeah.
And he was a lovely little Irish lad when I knew him.
How did you find out? Was it in the paper? Like, did someone tell you?
So I knew he had gone to jail.
Yeah.
And I left. That was the end of my second contract. But a friend of mine who was there, he sent me a link to all of Terry's things when he got out, and he became this very outspoken person in London.
Yeah.
And then he sent me a link when Terry, they filmed him driving up to the checkpoint and blowing himself up. And so you can actually Google Khalid Kelly. It's all there.
Wow. Mm. It's horrible.
Yeah.
Scary stuff. Mm. Especially when it just all stems from, I mean, Irish people, you know, they love a drink. We all know that.
They do.
Yeah.
I know. And then he's obviously got into the country, and I'm sure he would have tried to be sober, but then gotten into that crowd and just.
Well, like I said, I mean, in any city in the world, you could, if you want to find illicit things, you can find them.
Mm-hmm.
And Riyadh was no different. But just remember, there is potentially a high price to pay for doing things illegally, wherever you go.
Mm. Yeah.
And Saudi's no different.
And I guess on the topics of illegal, we wanted to also cover the topic of homosexuality or, you know, being gay. It's obviously illegal in Saudi.
It's haram is the word. Haram means forbidden in Islam. So in the Sultanate of Brunei, it's the same across the Islamic world. It's seen as, you know, blasphemous to God, and Saudi is no different. It's a criminal offence if you are caught living a homosexual relationship lifestyle. So that's a really big thing to bear in mind if you go there. Having said that, I worked with people that I knew were gay. But they were discreet. If you were indiscreet in anything that you did, then you would get yourself into trouble.
Yep.
And I knew many people that were thought they were more special than the locals, and they were indiscreet in whatever way, and they got into trouble.
Mm.
Yeah.
But then they would, when they were out of trouble, they would say, "Poor me," and you'd say, "Well, no, you're an idiot."
Yeah.
Yeah.
You're in a conservative Islamic country, respect the culture.
Yes.
If you're not going to respect the culture, at least be discreet.
Mm.
Is it true that they get stoned to death? Because that's what I used to get told when I would talk to people.
That is listed as an official punishment.
Yeah. And it's like a public stoning, isn't it? So who does that? Is it the police that will stone them? Or is it only if they physically see you doing it right there and then that they'll go and stone you?
I haven't heard of homosexuals being stoned to death for that.
Okay.
I know of someone in the hospital that was caught at a gay party that was raided, and that person was a Westerner, and there was a number of Westerners there, and they were deported immediately within 24 hours.
Okay.
But you are correct. Stoning is a punishment for a number of things. Adultery, I believe that women have been stoned more so than men. But we'd have to get the statistics on that. But the death penalty is very much alive and well in Saudi Arabia. It's generally by beheading.
Okay. Wow.
Beheading for men and stoning for women.
And is it a public thing or is it?
It is a public thing. So you could go to the Justice Palace on a Friday after prayer and it's a public event.
Whoa.
And certainly in the years when I was there, I know of people that went there, Western people, and they would push you up to the front to witness their justice in action.
Wow, that would have been so confronting.
I know, I don't agree with the death penalty, so I personally never went anywhere near the place. I walked through it unbeknownst when I first went there within the first 3 days.
Oh.
I went on a Friday.
God.
What, you got culture shock? Jesus.
And I didn't realise after I'd been through the place, they told me that was the Justice Palace and that was the square where they executed them.
Oh, my God.
And I had an executioner as a patient.
Oh, wow.
Oh.
So, and he told me at the time, I think he got the equivalent of about $250 per execution.
That's not a lot.
They don't do just one.
How many got a bust?
How many a day?
Yeah.
Well, jeez. I think there was a little note that within the last month that Saudi executed the most number of people in a single day that they'd ever done.
Whoa. What so, was it?
I would have to Google it and get the number, but it was a big number.
Even just one to me is a big number.
Like, yeah.
Just one to me blows my mind. Imagine if there was like...
I would not do it for $250. I wouldn't do it for any bucks, but like not for
not for any bucks. I mean, I hope not.
This person was a unique kind of person.
Yes.
Yeah, I think you'd have to be an executionist.
They,
What a title.
Yes, he was an interesting character.
I mean, we look after a lot of different types of patients, but I mean, that one's going to top the list.
Mm-hmm.
Looked after an executioner.
Yes. And he was quite proud of it. So.
Well, I mean, do you think you'd have to be if that was your job,
yep.
to be honest?
Wow, okay. Because I did, I remember I was telling somebody and I was saying, oh, we got the statistics up.
What was 81 that? People.
81 people on March the 12th, 2022. Oh, my God.
So he would have made whatever 81 times $250 is in that one day.
So that would have been across the kingdom. So that would have been in multiple locations. But in Riyadh, being the biggest city, I would imagine they would have had the most executions. So
wow. Fascinating.
Whoa.
Heavy. Is it, I mean, I know you didn't specifically go to see these beheadings or these executions, but is there any part of what you experienced in Saudi that left you with any kind of PTSD of the experience?
No.
Okay.
There was only one time where I felt unsafe, and that was when I was crossing the border between Saudi Arabia and Jordan in my little blue Jeep Wrangler with my very attractive wife who seems to look local wherever I go. So
she's a, what do you call it? She camouflages. She's a chameleon.
In those days she was very olive. She had dark hair. So she actually looked like girls of central Najd region of Saudi Arabia. They're very beautiful women. And so they'd see this very pretty Arab-looking girl with this white guy and think that's not right. But anyway, we were crossing the border and it was a very remote location that we were crossing from Saudi to Jordan. And these checkpoints, so you go in and it's a military zone and there's just soldiers everywhere.
Yeah.
And no one speaks English. It was a very, like I said, a very small outpost. And I don't think they'd seen a white guy and a white woman in a long time.
Wow.
And I drove right through the checkpoint to the very exit. And I hadn't got any papers done because I didn't know what I was doing.
Yeah.
And so we get to the no man's land where there's like a kilometre between Saudi and Jordan where there's nothing, and you have to drive across this.
Mm-hmm.
And it's like the last point. And so I'd driven right through, had no papers, get to this point, and two young soldiers are like, no, you got to go back. So we go back, we get the papers, we come back to them, and then they're like, oh, you go but leave your wife.
Oh.
Like, haha, that's funny. No. And then I could see them, you could see their little minds working over, and I'm thinking, these guys
oh, shit.
That's scary.
They're thinking bad things.
Mm-hmm. About your girl.
Correct. Mm-hmm. I could see they were thinking, could we get away with something here?
Oh, and God. I'm thinking,
this is a bad situation.
And they've got guns, I'm sure.
They had guns. I don't know if they're loaded. I know that a lot of them weren't loaded because they didn't trust them with loaded guns in those days. Right. But anyway, that might be different now.
Yeah.
And they had my passport and they had Kim's passport. And so, you know, I politely said, not funny, give me back the passports. And they, one of them kept the passports and I could see him, he was weighing up, what am I going to do?
Oh.
So then I said, look, give me back the passports now. And then they gave them back and we...
Get the fuck out.
But at the time, I was actually working for the royal family.
Okay.
And when I got back after that trip, I spoke to someone at the palace about that and they were livid. And
wow.
They were furious that had happened to us and they wanted to know who it was. And I said, look, it's fine. It's done nothing. There was no harm. But I said it was quite unpleasant. But they were very unhappy that had happened.
Mm.
But it was at a time pre-mobile phones. You know, yeah. There was no communication. Because they said, why don't you call? You call me. We would have sorted that out.
Like, how?
Yeah, man.
I'm in the middle of...
trying to ask them for my passport back. I can't be like, can I also borrow your phone? I'm just going to call the palace.
That was lovely. So they were really upset that had happened. And that was the one time in 5 years.
Okay.
And my wife and I, we drove all over Saudi Arabia, just the two of us, and we never felt unsafe at any other time. In fact, we were more often than not welcomed wherever we went.
Okay.
So, yeah, let's rewind to the, you know, quite a big topic you said there. You work for the royal family?
That's cool.
So... our hospital, like Faisal, to this day, I noticed is still patronized by the current royal family.
Mm.
I think when King Fahad was king, when King Abdullah was king, so he was. The family is very complicated. So it's a very big family. Original King Abdulaziz, he married. Lots of women from all the tribes to unite the country.
Mm-hmm. Oh, lots of wives then. So had, they do that there. Okay.
He had more than four. He had lots and lots of children to different women. So they're all brothers, but they're half brothers.
Right.
It's a big family.
Mm.
You'd be scared to date. You'd be like, are you my sister?
Exactly. I don't think they care there, to be honest.
When King Abdullah was in charge, so the hospital, the royal hospital, became his hospital.
Right.
King Abdullah had a different hospital, the National Guard hospital. So Faisal stopped being the royal hospital, but I believe that the current King Salman visits Faisal.
Okay. Wow.
So
cool.
So what happens when the royals come in? Is there's a lot of royals in Saudi Arabia. There's thousands and thousands of them. But there's only about 100 that are the big shots. And so there was a separate entire wing in the years that I was there just for the top 100.
Wow.
And there was a wing that was just a VIP wing for the other 6,000. But people were constantly coming in and saying, I'm a royal, I want to go to...
that wing.
That wing. And the hospital in those days actually employed a member of the royal family. They were called the executive on duty, who would come down and eyeball them and say, you're not, you're going over there.
Wow.
But
eyeball them. I know all 6,000, you're not one.
but all of them, you know, everyone knew who the top 100.
Yeah,
they yeah.
We all knew who they were. They didn't have to prove anything, and they were entitled to this separate part of the hospital. So when they came in, the hospital would staff it according. Like if it was a male member of the royal family, then there would be a male staff, and working with female staff. So, mm-hmm. and it was usually critical care people.
Yep.
So you didn't get a choice. You couldn't say, I want to do VIP duty.
Yep.
It's just the hospital would go, KJ, you're going to staff this now.
Mm-hmm.
X, Y, or Z is coming in and you're going to look after them until they leave.
Wow.
So if they're in for a week, you were there for a week.
Yeah.
But they would obviously have a team. So there'd be a 12-hour shift, so they'd have a day team and a night team.
Wow, that's very cool.
But the problem was if they liked you, then they wanted you.
Mm.
So then those top 100 had the right to take staff from King Faisal to go and work with them.
Okay.
So there was girls that were working with people in the United States and caring for them in the United States, paid for by King Faisal Specialist Hospital. These were old royals, but they were residing in Southern California.
Wow.
So they had a team of American nurses working in Saudi Arabia, employed by Saudi Arabia, now living in the United States caring for this person until she died, and then that team would come back.
And that's fascinating.
So a colleague of mine, she became she was in charge of the king at the time of his private clinic.
Wow.
So he had staff with him wherever he went. So she was in charge of the nursing side of things. And quite a number of those staff were Australians. And it was just, like I said, you didn't have a choice. But if you got chosen and you worked with them and they liked you, then they always wanted, they liked the same faces.
Yeah.
Did you get to work with the top 100?
I worked with the top 100.
Oh.
That's cool.
We're all thinking it. I was like, I want to just go in and die for it.
I said they wouldn't like KJ. Of course they liked KJ.
I
know.
I did 6 months at the Aliyamama Palace for the king who at the time. If you ever work with VIPs or royals, if you go to Saudi and you work with royals, you don't talk about what you do to anyone. You don't gossip.
Yeah.
You be professional. You treat them with respect. I would like to think I didn't treat them any differently to anyone else. I treated them with respect and honesty, and I was treated with respect back.
Yeah.
But I never talked to other people at the time about what I was doing. You know, these people are hugely influential.
Yeah.
They're powerful people.
Yeah, definitely powerful.
And they're fascinating people. And and you're part of their life when you're there. You're witnessing things. But you don't talk about that.
Yeah.
The odd person went and worked with royals and they'd talk about it, they'd be gone.
Yeah, yeah.
But you wouldn't do that for anyone. If you're working for the Kardashians and you talked about them, they'd kick you out. They'd find out,
for sure.
100%.
So if you ever have the opportunity, it's an amazing opportunity.
Incredible experience.
But don't talk about it.
Until like years and years later. It's been a long time.
I would never talk about specifics.
Yeah, yeah, exactly.
But just talk about your role with them.
Mm-hmm.
And I was invited to go on the staff, permanent staff of one of the lesser 100.
Yeah, yeah.
Which was an honour. They never ask you directly.
Mm-hmm.
It's always if they like you, they tell their staff.
Right.
Or they tell the hospital. They say, I was the Australian. They'd say, we want the Australian.
Well, the Aussie one.
And then the administration would come to you and say, this person has asked that you, would you consider working with them?
Mm.
Well, they don't say, would you consider? They'd say, the words were, it would be very beneficial for the hospital if you would work for them.
Mm.
Yeah. Still, it's pretty cool. It's pretty amazing to be like.
That was lovely. And I got to do that 3 separate occasions.
Nice.
And so 3 royals and 1 VIP. So in Saudi, there's the royal family and then there's the financiers. So the royals govern, and then there's the business people.
Mm.
So that was kind of the deal when the kingdom was created.
Yeah.
So the last group that I worked with were the money people. And so they advised the royal family. They're on the board of everything. And I had the honour of setting up basically an intensive care in their home.
Mm.
So they lived very close to the palace.
Yeah.
They were beautiful people. Though I had free reign of their home.
Wow.
At one stage they actually asked me about moving to Australia. That they mm-hmm. loved us so much. They were very impressed with our healthcare.
Imagine.
So they were looking at moving to the Gold Coast. They loved the Gold Coast, but ultimately they didn't.
Yeah.
But that was a real honour.
Mm.
Yeah. So he was a patient in intensive care, and I looked after him one day, and it was the same deal. They said, "We like the Australian," and then they looked at transitioning him home, permanently ventilated, and so then they went to the hospital and said, "Can this Australian do this for us?"
Okay.
Then the hospital comes to you and says, "They've asked if you would oversee his transition. Will you do it for us? It'll be nice for the hospital."
Mm-hmm.
Cool. How can you say no?
So how did he go being home? It was just ventilated until he passed.
These guys imported all the medical equipment into Saudi Arabia.
Wow.
So when they first asked me, I dealt with his brother, the patient's brother, who was a lovely man. And I said, "I'm happy to do this, but you have to give me everything that I want."
Mm.
And this became a running joke with us because they imported all the medical equipment into Saudi. So I got whatever I wanted, the best of everything.
Wow.
And on the day that we were going to take him home for the first time, ventilator dependent, I had organized ambulance, like a big hoo-ha. And his brother came to me and he said, KJ, we want to take him home in our own vehicle. And so I had this crazy flash of me sticking him in the back of a Rolls Royce with a ventilator. That was my initial.
Just him like sitting up and just bagging him, and he's just like looking out.
That was my initial stupid thought, but I should have known better because his brother was amazing. And I said, just politely, I said, "Oh, look, do you mind if I actually look at the vehicle before we do this?" And he had this little twinkle in his eye, like, "You're going to be impressed."
Oh.
But he didn't say anything because he was always very understated. And he said, yeah. He said, "KJ, it's parked out the front of a hospital. God. Just go and have a look." So I go out there and here's this luxury motorhome, like this monstrous motorhome, decked out with everything that you could imagine. Like my patient, he'd go in his electric wheelchair into an electronic lift that would put him up in the middle of this command post inside this luxury vehicle, everything you could imagine.
Oh,
like,
wow.
Like fabulous.
Wow.
So his brother knew it was amazing.
Yeah.
So I've come back and he knows it's good and I know it's good. And he says to me, "KJ, what did you think?" I said, yeah, that's good. Like we're both being very understated. And then his classic line, which I loved him for, he said, "Yeah, we got two of those." So everything that I wanted, I had two or three of the best that you could ever wish for.
Nice.
And he had the most amazing care. He had seven nurses that they'd already organized and they just wanted me to make sure that they were beautiful Filipino staff, but they just wanted me to oversee that everything was up to standard. Beautiful family.
What
amazing experience.
Yeah.
I
sadly, it was the time when pre-digital and I have some film.
Mm.
I have a photo of all of us, all the brothers and my patient together in their, I'm going to say their home, but it was like a palace.
In the palace.
It's just in their palace.
Can I tell, I want to tell a story.
That,
so my patient, he was only young when he this happened to him. It was terrible. And he's a lovely man. And so one of his children, the youngest child, was probably only about 3 or 4. He's super cute. And they all had nannies. So I remember standing in the foyer of this palatial home, and you could see multiple levels and little children running everywhere.
Oh, my gosh.
And then a nanny running behind them. So the nannies were constantly with them. One day, early in the morning, one of the little boys lost his nanny.
Oh.
Like, he wanted to lose it. He wanted some
alone time.
Okay, yeah, yeah.
So, and he found me, and I was down having breakfast, and he came up. He's, KJ, what are you having for breakfast? He spoke very good English. And I said, whatever the chef had prepared me.
Yeah.
Because they had industrial kitchen and staff everywhere. And he said, I'd like to have the same. I said, well, go and ask the chef and he'll make it for you.
Yeah.
So he did, and the chef brought in the food. And we're having this beautiful breakfast together, him and I. And I said to him, you talk to me in English and I'll talk to you in Arabic, and we'll both, we'll practice. And so we're having this beautiful morning, and his nanny was obviously beside herself because she'd lost him in this huge home. And eventually she discovered him. And I thought, the poor little bugger, he didn't get a minute to himself. So he was happily feeding himself, but the minute she found him, she just snatched the spoon out of his face and started shoving this food in. Tears and disaster, and it was a classic moment.
Yeah.
Oh, I would have meant so much to him, being like, oh, I could just breathe.
Yeah.
So, it was interesting. So they never had a minute to themselves.
Yeah.
But the nannies had to be seen to be of use to remain employed.
Yeah.
So.
Oh, yeah, I reckon he still remembers that time with you.
I still remember it, so maybe.
Yeah.
I
think
he would. Like the one time I had some moment to myself and I made that friend.
So love good. That.
Actually, we didn't brush over just quickly, like, your experiences obviously as a male.
Yes.
With very females. Different. Can you just give us a rough view for any female listeners that potentially want to go to Saudi?
Yes. Very important to get a perspective from someone who's going to be doing the exact role that you're doing. My big mistake was I talked to lots of people who were doing similar roles but not the same. And they were female and I was male.
Yeah.
And I was single at the time. So the initial stories that I had in my head didn't match up to my experience, because as a single male I was sent downtown away from the hospital. Females lived on the hospital in very nice accommodation. So depending on your grade, what your role was would determine the quality of housing that you lived in. So girls were in very high demand. So you could potentially be out at – there's a lot of private compounds in Riyadh, well, across Saudi, by multinational companies – put their staff in these compounds, and it's like living in middle-class American suburb or a little English country town, depending on who's running the show. So girls would get invited to those things all the time. As a single male, men working on those compounds don't want another male there, so I'd never get invited in the first 6 months. So the girls were very much in demand, and you could have an amazing, very busy social life. But again, you need to be very discreet
and
cautious
and
follow the rules. But I'd say to guys, you might not have such a great time initially. I lived – the first year was very unpleasant for me. I lived in single male accommodation. I wasn't allowed to entertain single women. So even as my colleagues couldn't come there unless we had a married couple to supervisors.
Wow.
Very lonely then.
So it was hard.
Yeah.
Conversely, I guess, not advocating this, but if you were two men in a relationship and you were discreet, you could go there, live together and
be happy.
You'd be happy.
And be super discreet.
And that happened
a lot.
in my building, it was called Gayalaya.
Gayalaya, wow.
Because there was a lot of discreet gay men living yeah. there.
Boinking.
Wow.
Secretly.
Yes.
What about sexism in the workplace with males, I guess males looking after women or women looking after men or vice versa? How, was there any kind of sexism in the hospital at all?
Culturally, that women in the workforce was definitely a new thing and there were limited roles that women, Saudi women could undertake.
Yep.
There's lots of, like we were saying, it's tribal, so there's a lot of inter-tribal distrust. So they struggled early on, I believe, with Saudis looking after Saudis because of long-standing tribal feuds. So women could teach, women could be nurses. When I first went there in the 90s, they're the first Saudi nurses graduate.
Wow.
They didn't do clinical. They ended up going straight to management or education roles.
Wow.
So, but I'm sure that times have changed because they have, you know, one of the fastest growing populations in the world.
Yeah. Yeah.
They have a vast number of young people that they need to employ. So, and I know in the early 2000s, they went through an Arabization program where they were phasing out, well, they were trying to phase out the number of Westerners in the hospital. And that was just, they needed to employ their own people.
Yeah.
So sexism, culturally, it is different.
Yeah.
Witnessing as a male, I think, overall, they were very respectful. They didn't like aggressive women. If you're a strong, aggressive woman, if you're dealing with an Arab doctor, they would struggle with that. They don't like confrontation from an aggressive female.
Yep, fair enough.
And they won't say anything to you, but they will take it up.
Yeah.
Behind, I hate those types of doctors.
Behind the scenes. But that's a cultural thing.
I mean, yeah. Oh, I happen to see you too, though. You know?
Yeah.
Yes. But I'd say no.
Yeah.
You know, no. There wasn't. In our hospital, anyway, Faisal was a. It's a flagship hospital of the Middle East.
Yeah.
Had renowned staff from all over the world. There was a high level of education of most of the people working there. And it was a premier place for Saudis to be employed at. So they were well-educated. The young people learnt English.
Yep.
So it was an interesting place.
Mm. Yeah, cool. And I know because it was obviously quite a while ago that you went, but I know financially
money.
With you know, not having to pay tax, you were making quite a lot of money. You kind of mentioned to us about 140K a year roughly. Give or take.
That was the last time I was there in 2002, and it was a six-month contract, and there was bonuses there because I had worked there before.
Okay.
It didn't cost them as much to – essentially, they're just rehiring me, so they didn't have to pay big upfront fees. Okay.
And that's when you made the 70K in 6 months?
Yes.
Yeah, okay. That's awesome.
But I did work hard, and I did get a nice bonus. If you worked with...
Well, you were up at the world.
Yeah.
If you worked with VIPs, they could be very generous if they liked you.
That's nice.
Wow.
And if they give you things there, it's completely culturally acceptable to accept gifts. And in fact, you would insult them if you didn't.
Oh, I like that.
So we can't even get chocolates half the time.
Yeah. It's like a rule that we shouldn't even accept chocolates.
Yeah.
God, okay, that's nice. Wow. When we had signed our contracts, we were offered around $6,000 a month.
Australian, yeah.
And then at the end, I think it was a $2,500 US bonus with the 10 weeks of annual leave, which we were kind of okay with, but we wanted to negotiate a higher price just because we were leaving so much behind. But while we're in the middle of negotiation, we found out that podcast was illegal, so we just decided to scrap the whole thing anyway. But
other thing, I know it will be very different now to obviously – back in the early 2000s, but like, how did you get your money back to Australia?
Well, we had a tax-free agreement. Australia had a tax-free agreement with Saudi for health professionals that that we were tax exempt.
It doesn't happen now.
So I believe it's been scrapped.
Yeah, it's been scrapped.
So I think no matter where you work in the world now, even if you're in a tax-free zone,
you have to pay it. You'll pay that money.
You'll pay tax if you try and bring it back into Australia.
So sorry, guys, we don't have any of that information.
Yeah, there's definitely like a certain amount you can bring in per year or per month that's you can do untaxed. But yeah.
We have some contacts in Saudi at the moment. So you can obviously DM us and we can chat to you about it privately. But
Cayman Islands.
Switzerland Bank.
Perfect. This has been epic. I think we've covered so much.
We have.
KJ, you've been such a legend. Thank you so much for coming onto our podcast today. We're so appreciated.
It was an honour to be asked.
Aww.
Even if it just helps one person to have a good...
Yes.
An easier time there.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
But like I said... You could have an amazing time there. They're lovely people.
Yeah. Mm. Certainly. Sort of going with an open view and open mind and just
and do your research.
Embrace it.
Respect the culture.
Thank you.
Perfect. Well, what are we sending, Zana?
Love, life and laughter always.
See you later, guys.